Let's think about a movement called restoration or restorationism. The frontier in the 1820s, the 1830s, 40s, 50s, the wild frontier, Tennessee, Kentucky, Indiana, Illinois, Missouri, the wild frontier was also wild in terms of Christianity. There were no other brands of religion on the frontier. The closest you could get was Johnny Appleseed and Swedenborgianism, which is an odd, that is not crazy, but odd version of Christianity. But what you had on the frontier was a mobile population, people living in isolated areas, isolated from one another. You also had the people that were going out to the frontier being innovators. If you weren't an innovator, if you weren't a go-getter type person, if you weren't a person who was eager for change, you'd stay home. You'd stay back in Troy, New York, and be burned over. But if you had gumption and get up and go, you were kind of a forward-thinking or non-traditional type person, you'd go to the frontier and you'd stake your claim and you'd carve out a place for yourself and your family in the wilderness. You left your values, perhaps. At least you left those institutions which underscored your values. And from a Christian evangelical point of view, the frontier presented a ripe field for evangelism. Here were people who were cut off from their roots, cut off from a lot of their family, and who had no church to go to if they were inclined to go to a church at all. So the religious groups that made it on the frontier were the Baptists and the Methodists and the Disciples. Those are the big three of the American frontier in terms of religion. I'm going to mention Roger Williams in a minute, the father of the Baptist movement in this country. The Methodists I'm not going to talk about because though they are a new religious movement in relationship to Anglicanism, out of which Methodism comes, it comes to this country as one of the big three frontier religions. So it really isn't a new religious movement in America, though hugely influential on the frontier and after the frontier period was over. Anybody that's been to a small town in Indiana and says that there's no Methodist church on the green lies. Every one of them has a Methodist church. Hugely influential. I want to focus for a moment on the restoration movement. The Campbells, Thomas and Alexander, one's a father and one's a son. I think Thomas is the father and Alexander is the son. Anyway, they come from the old country. They come from Scotland with their sort of Presbyterian heritage. And they go out to be evangelists on the frontier to take the gospel to the pioneers and to the Native American populations. And they see that the frontier is a very confusing scene, just like upstate New York was for the Joseph Smiths of this world, for the William Millers of this world. There's every Tom, Dick, and Harry type of Christianity being preached. Presbyterian, you know, Methodist, etc., etc. And the Campbells were deeply offended by this. They thought that the kind of Christianity that should be preached on the new frontier shouldn't be the old stuff. Not in the sense, grace that, it shouldn't be the old stuff denominationally. That belongs to the past. Now, God, in this day, on the frontier, with new effervescent thinking happening and new things happening all the time, what was God doing? God was calling the people to unity. So the Campbells said, let's restore the original design of the church. And where do you find that? You find that in the New Testament. So restorationism is a heavily biblicistic movement. And you see that particularly in the churches of Christ. Now, how do we get this? Campbell said, erase all the denominations, let's just call ourselves Christians. And of course, the crowning irony of restorationism is that the way to unity among the Christians is the establishment of a new denomination. Restorationism refers to the LDS, Latter-day Saints, who are restoring original Israel in preparation for what? The advent of Christ, the millennial kingdom, the second coming of Christ. And it refers to the Campbellite movement. The Campbellite movement called itself simply Christian until the Civil War. The Civil War was a watershed for a lot in American history, as you know. And one of the things that happened was the breakup of the Campbellite movement into a liberal and a conservative, into liberal and conservative camps. Not surprising, huh? The Christians, just us Christian church folk, who accepted some of the new biblical criticism, for example, that was coming from Germany and England, styled themselves the Christian Church Disciples of Christ, headquarters Indianapolis. One of the standard liberal Protestant denominations today. The other group after the Civil War called itself the Churches of Christ. There's really only one kind of Christian disciples headquartered in Indianapolis. There are all sorts of offshoots of the Campbellite movement that call themselves Churches of Christ. There are, for example, Churches of Christ non-instrumental. You ever seen a sign that says non-instrumental? That harks back to the biblicism. They say you can't find the use of instruments like organs in New Testament worship. Conclusion, we don't use them. Because the early church didn't use them. And what are we doing? We're restoring original Christianity. And you can't play the original Christian tune on an organ because they didn't have them. There are Churches of Christ instrumentalists who will play the fiddle or play the organ or have somebody strum a guitar. You see the entrepreneurial spirit in America? It comes out not only in the creation of companies, it comes in the creation of new angles of vision on Christianity and New Age and everything else. It's a tremendously fertile ground for the production of new ideas. So, there we have it with restorationism. Now, we've been talking about the millennial kingdom that is very important in the thought of many people in the early 19th century, before the turn of the century. Out of that excitation and expectation of the coming of the Lord comes a movement called Adventism. And out of that general Adventist fervor and confidence that the Bible can allow us to read the signs of the times, the signs that point to the coming of Christ, out of that general Adventism comes Ellen Gould White, who fashions Seventh-day Adventism. Adventism itself is not necessarily Sabbatarian. That is, Christians who observe Saturday rather than Sunday, Jewishly, as it were. But Ellen Gould White puts this package together of healthism and Sabbatarianism and the soon second coming of Jesus and the prophethood of herself, and creates Seventh-day Adventism. About 60 years ago, in the 30s, a group separated itself from the main body of mainstream middle America Seventh-day Adventism. Now, once the door is open to millenarianism, once the door is open to the excitement of Jesus coming very soon, rather than in the far distant future, once you open the door to the possibility that today's newspaper and yesteryear's New Testament can be correlated in a very straightforward one-to-one way, where am I going with this metaphor? The horse is out of the barn, you know, and it's a free-for-all, you see. You loose this kind of millennial energy, and who can stop it? The mainstream Seventh-day Adventist can say, oh, wait, we're not crazy, you know, we're not predicting the end of the world tomorrow. Don't give up your subscription to the New York Times, you know. Don't sell all your property. You know, let's give to missions. Let's be mainstream Christians. Don't go off crazy. See? But the Branch Davidians say, forget that. You know, we have a more exciting brand of Adventism to offer. What you say is, the signs of the times that we read in the New Testament tell us that we are living in the very, very, very last days. You add to that the notion that there has got to be a strong leader who can tell the people the truth and can rally them together to be ready for the second coming of Christ. Now, do you see how easy it is then to slip over to the next level, which is for that strong person to say that he in fact is the coming of Christ? And that's what you have with the Branch Davidians. David Koresh ousted a few years ago the original leader of the Branch Davidians that came from mainstream Seventh-day Adventism, and set up this compound in Waco. Is he premillennialist or postmillennialist? He's premillennialist. He's saying the world is evil. The world is against true Christians. Can you find evidence of that in the New Testament? Of course. You know, shun the world. You are not of the flesh, but of the spirit. All sorts of Manichaean dichotomies that you can find in the Bible, and you can put them together in a particular saleable package. There are other ways to put those passages together with other passages, and so the New Testament itself is a kind of fertile ground for multivalence, as the highbrows say. Things can mean a lot of things. So you say that Jesus predicted that just a few, just a remnant, just a little group is going to be faithful to the end. And the world outside is obviously under the control of one of the favorite figures in premillennialism, the Antichrist. And they, the powers of darkness, the powers of Satan, have weapons. And so the people of God, in order to be ready, in order to defend themselves and wait for the coming of the end, have to arm themselves also. It's necessary. It's a strategy in the world. Well, you know the rest. What's going to happen to them, I don't know. There are, a couple thousand, 3,000 Branch Davidians around the world. There's a concentration in Australia. Koresh a few years ago went to Australia preaching this doctrine and gathering people into little groups. So you never know what's going to happen after a charismatic leader dies.
Bruce?
Yeah.
I didn't like the way our government handled that Waco incident at all. I thought it was terrible that that they went in there and stormed him and got him however the fire started, you know. If they really wanted him, they could have taken him weeks or months before that,
yeah,
that ever happened. But I thought it was terrible.
Well, I did too, and you know, you and I were talking the other day about that. The government in this case and other cases gets bad information. Now, I don't know if this tragedy could have been averted or not. Nobody knows that. But if you would reel the video back and start over, which we'd all like to do, you know, and they had the good sense to ask me, I would have to have the good sense to give them the telephone number of J. Gordon Melton, the editor of the Encyclopedia of American Religion, who is an absolute... He's not a real person, he's a computer that looks like a person. You know? And he has, he never looks at a note. He's got all the dates and facts up here, see? And he's the guy that knows the Branch Davidians, and nobody else knew what the Cobb they were. They're so tiny, they don't appear on the radar screen, you know? I mean, 2,000 people in the whole world, who's gonna know about them, you know? Heck, the State Department didn't know what Shiite Islam was, you know, when Khomeini came back from Paris. What's this? You know, this guy in a robe and sandal, he's supposed to be a big deal. We're back in the Shah. Well, the Shah's out, the guy in this robe and sandals is in. You know, and the State Department is going to the library. They don't know anything. So they should have called J. Gordon Melton, and Melton would have told them that, yeah, there is a possibility of violence. Of course, you can't rule that out. But in the main, these groups are not harmful. Now, they may appear to be harmful to certain individuals in them, but there again, you get to that fine line where the government begins to say, these are the good religions and these are the bad religions. See? The test case of that, of course, is not Waco, Texas. The test case of that is Christian Science, which comes out of the New Thought movement, which is also a product of the 30s and 40s in the 19th century. Lots of stuff was happening religiously in the early decades of the 19th century, before the turn of the century. Lots of really interesting things. And New Thought, of which Christian Science is a type, says that thought precedes everything. The essence of the universe is mind. So if you change the mind, you change the material circumstances. And our position as an American government on religious freedom is that it is absolute, right? You have the absolute right to believe anything you want and to practice your religion in any way you want. Everybody would agree with that. Except when you break a law. See, like child endangerment. So this is a source of tremendous conflict publicly and in the minds of judges and attorneys when a child dies. The child of a Christian Science couple. And the Christian Science argument is, you people are hypocrites. Religious freedom stops with us. We are being persecuted because of the child. Because we pray over the child. This is our method. And if you were not so prejudiced, you society, were not so prejudiced against healing by prayer, that is, if you weren't so materialistically oriented and hadn't bought into the majority reality tradition, which is dualistic tradition, you would have allowed us to make our experiments, J. just as the medical establishments make its experiment. And what you would see is that about the same number of people recover and about the same number of people don't recover under Christian Science practitioners as under traditional physicians. But you, society, don't allow us to do that, and we are being persecuted. See, the other argument, of course, is you can't do that. You can do it for yourself, but you can't do it for a minor, because the minor can't believe or not believe. You're believing for that child, and you're culpable. Yeah.
I just want to go back to the French Divinian. I don't understand. I understand that that is a break off from the Seventh-day Advent. But is the group that was at Waco, is that the center of the Branch Davidian, or
yes,
is there other groups of, yep, Branch Davidian in the United States at the present time?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, who,
but they don't have big compounds like the one in Waco. They're more like house churches.
Well, is Koresh the leader of that?
Yes.
Well, they're without a leader at the moment, other, yeah, than some self-appointed.
Right.
Oh,
right.
Mm-hmm.
And the Branch Davidian business, that name, that title, alludes to the idea that in Christian tradition, stemming from the Old Testament, the Messiah, the coming one, comes as a branch off of the root of David, the Davidic covenant, the Davidic dynasty. So it's like, you know, it's the Davidic tree, and the Messiah comes as a branch off of that tree, rooted in God's promises. Okay? That's, so they are the branch of David's people, the Branch Davidians. Okay, any more questions? Now, Jehovah's Witnesses. Why do we talk about them here? They are not restorationists. But the founder of the Jehovah's Witnesses, Charles Taze Russell, was very interested in Miller's ideas. So you see that William Miller, died 1847, has had a lot of influence on subsequent movements. Russell, in the 1880s, got interested in some Adventist, Millerite, millenarian notions, began studying the Bible with that in mind, with those sort of millenarian glasses on, got real excited by the book of Daniel, and concluded that that the world was in the last times. So he sets up an organization of Bible students. And when your friendly Jehovah's Witnesses come to your door, you know, they will say, "We are Bible students." And they will ask you to study the Bible with them. That goes all the way back to Russell's first efforts at founding a Bible study group. Okay. Eventually this becomes the Watchtower Bible and Tract Society. Why Watchtower? Because Christians should be like those sentries on the top of the watchtowers, watching for what? Second coming of Christ. That's right, the millennial king. See, I mean, there's a lot of stuff here that relates back to that one central idea. Now, Russell was a date setter like his mentor, William Miller. And Russell set the date of 1917 as the end of the world and the beginning of the millennial kingdom. Guess what? What happens in disappointments is either the group goes out of existence, or the other obvious thing is reinterpreted. So what you say is, and what Russell did say, was that It actually happened, but in this heavenly realm. Christ came into his kingdom in the heavenly realm. And we are living in the time in which God is gathering together a finite number of true believers. When the number that God only knows is converted and becomes subject to the reign of Jehovah, then the end will come. So that the missionary activity is not to save people from eternal damnation, because what happens to you when you die as a non-Jehovah's Witness is that you are extinguished. So there's no torment in hell. There is a hell in a sense, but it extinguishes you, so you're gone. So it's not to save you from hell, but the missionary work of the Jehovah's Witnesses is to hasten the end. Now, they also have a very strict dichotomy between the ins and the outs, the friends and the foes, the world, and those who are on the inside, which is typical of millenarianism, isn't it? Evil world, holy people of God. Who gets saved? Holy people of God. Who gets crushed? Them. They get it. See, God's wrath falls on them. Charles Taze Russell said that the magic number was 144,000. Well, that was in the early days, right? What happened when there were 144,001 people who had signed on with the Watchtower folks? Well, you do some reinterpreting and you say that there will be more than 144,000 on a certain level, but that there is an elite group of 144,000, the last one of which has not yet been converted. No one knows who that 144,000th person is going to be. Only Ed McMahon knows. And when that person has converted, he personally will. Okay. All right. Any questions about Jehovah's Witnesses? One of the true blue American religious movements.
Well, I guess I have a question. So they're working on the second tier of 144,000?
Well, they're working on both levels.
Right.
The mass level has a number, and then the number of the elite is 144,000.
These are one of the groups, too, that are considered non-Christians, right?
Well, by some, yeah. But,
well, I mean, I thought there were three. The Mormons, the Jehovah's Witnesses, and the other.
And the Christian Scientists.
Yeah,
right. Well, read them out. No, but see, it depends on what you define as a Christian. If you define Christian as standard brand evangelical Christian, they deviate significantly from that.
I thought maybe it had to do with their belief in the Trinity. I don't know where I got that, but that was...
All right, that's a criterion. That's true. The Mormons don't have the Trinity. Jehovah's Witnesses do not. Their Christology is Arian. That goes back to the 3rd century and the Arian controversy, out of which we get the Nicene Creed. So in the Nicene Creed, Jesus is elevated to the Godhead. Right? You know that from Catechism?
I happen to find out how that Nicene Creed happened to be written. I think it's very verbal. And when you get done with it, you don't know what it said.
Well, you can study it, though, and it is meaningful, and it's the product of Greek philosophy and politics.
Yeah, because Constantine wanted to move to Byzantium at that time.
Right.
Yeah.
That's
and
right.
So he did. He shut them in and said, you don't come out.
Do it or else. You don't come out until you get the... That's exactly right. Yeah. It happened over a period of years, but that's the idea, yeah. Uh-huh. So in the Nicene Creed you say that Jesus is of one ousia, or substance, with the Father, with God. So he is elevated to the Godhead along with the Spirit. So you have a Trinity. You don't have that in Jehovah's Witnesses. The Jehovah's Witness idea of Christ is that he is kind of a junior God, or the instrument of God's working, but not in any sense part of the Godhead.
When the Mormons speak of their Latter-day Saints, Jesus Christ, the Latter-day Saints, or however you get that in.
Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
What God now is, we are. What we are now, God once was. So you can, you know, work through those spiritual planes. Yeah. Explain, the Jehovah's Witnesses don't celebrate Christmas.
Right.
Explain that, please.
Well, that's easily explained when you think of the inside-outside dichotomy. The outside world, including the churches who have baptized the solstice festival and all that stuff, you know, Roman solstice festival, are under the control of the devil. The Mormons used to have a kind of litany in which they would condemn Protestant ministers and Catholic priests and every other kind of minister. They don't do that anymore. So they're kind of trying to mainstream themselves. But the Jehovah's Witnesses have no interest in ingratiating themselves at all. You know, they're in your face. You Christians have sold out. You've taken a pagan festival and made it part of your liturgical calendar. That's of the devil. God doesn't want that. We are the true witnesses of Jehovah. So we are completely against any kind of involvement with the world that is the kingdom of Antichrist. And that means we don't vote. That means we don't serve in the military. And they were tremendously persecuted during World War I and Korea. World War II, Korea, etc. Not only in this country. We don't like the idea of taxes. I mean, we do have to pay them, but we don't pay them reluctantly. And we try to get by as much as possible with a kind of intra-JW economy. You're a plumber, you come over and fix my plumbing, and you know, I'm a carpenter, and I'll help you out with your drywall project. Then we don't have to pay Uncle the Devil Sam. You see how the world picture is? The ins and the outs. And we don't want anything to do with the outs, because they're condemned by God. Yeah.
Were the Unitarians getting started about this time too?
The Unitarians. The Unitarians get started even earlier. Unitarians get started in the late 18th century. You know, you think of Boston as the bastion of the Kennedys. And what are the Kennedys? Are they Unitarians? No, they're Catholics. You know, you think of, you know, sort of the Boston Irish. But there's an earlier stratum or class in Boston, and that is a highly educated Puritan strand of thinking, a rather aristocratic kind of people in Boston. And these are people who are pure, some of them are Puritans, some of them are Anglicans in the 18th century. And they, because they are of a scholarly bent, are reading Enlightenment materials. They're reading books that are written by very progressive left-wing Christians in England and other countries in Europe. that question, for example, the deity of Christ, that question, for example, the Mosaic authorship of the first five books of the Hebrew Bible. In other words, they are higher critics, right? And there are people in this kind of intellectual elite in Boston that are reading this stuff and taking it very seriously. And at one point in the late 18th century, at King's Chapel in Boston, the clergy at that very influential downtown Anglican, that is Episcopal, church, decide that the Trinity is a bum deal, that they made a mistake at Nicaea, in Constantinople. They made a mistake in confecting the Trinity doctrine. In fact, the Trinity doctrine goes against a fundamental tenet of the Hebrew religion, which is monotheism. Okay? So, they say we are Unitarians rather than Trinitarian. Unitarian is against, it's a polemical word, against Trinitarians. They have a pair of scissors there in Boston, and they take the Book of Common Prayer and they snip out all of the references to the Trinity. King's Chapel, Boston. So some of the leading Anglican thinkers in Boston become the leaders of the new Unitarian movement. There's another movement that gets started about that time called Universalism, which gets its energy from being against the idea of Calvin, which is that some are saved and some are damned. Right? Predestination. They say no, everybody eventually will be saved. The saving work of Christ will cover all. Universal salvation. In 1961, the Unitarians and Universalists joined to form the Unitarian Universalist Association, headquarters, Boston. Tiny group, influential, out of proportion to their numbers. Look down a list of senators and representatives in the Congress. There are, if you looked at the numbers of Unitarians, which is way under a million in this country, you'd say, well, statistically, they're probably maybe a half or one. But there are many.
Well, what is their concept, I'm curious, of Christ then, if they do not believe in the Trinity?
Well, you can't say, because the Unitarian Universalist Church is one of extreme theological diversity. About the only shade of opinion that would not be welcome would be a conservative Christianity. So that if you, let's say you were church shopping and you came from a conservative or even rather liberal Christian faith, but you really, you know, central to it was the gospel that Jesus saves us from our sins or some such formulation. You might go to Methodist church and think, well, that's pretty good, you know. And then maybe you go to Baptist, well, that's a little bit too much, you know, and then Lutheran church, ah, that's good. Then you unless it's an old ALC church. But then you go to Unitarian church. What's this? You know, what? Why aren't they reading from the Bible? Why are they reading from Ralph Waldo Emerson? Why does nobody mention God? Why did they just talk about the spirit of life? Why, if they mentioned Christ at all, it's that he has something interesting to say about perhaps a political topic that somebody's talking about. Why in the world, in the narthex, the vestibule of the church, do they have all these political causes that you can sign up for? Abortion rights, all sorts of lefty causes. What the cow is this? You know, is this Christianity? Well, there you really stress the definition of Christianity. In England, Unitarianism tends to take on a more Christian coloration. And so you will find people in England who are Unitarians who in this country might be United Church of Christ or disciples, way left. Hang pretty loose on the doctrine of the Trinity, pretty loose on the deity of Christ, but still kind of hanging in with the language and symbols of Christianity. The language and symbols of Christianity pretty much go out the window with Unitarian Universalism. The Unitarian Fellowship is a place for people who either were not reared in the Christian tradition, or have become disaffected from the Christian tradition, but are not willing to say, I'm a secular humanist and I don't want to go to any place where anything like the spirit of life, or even God, or the gods, or the sacred is mentioned. So there's a narrow band of people that are going to be potential customers for Unitarian Universalism. But one other thing, Jews are disproportionately represented in Unitarian Universalist congregation. They themselves talk about Junitarians. These are Jews who probably were reared in a very secular Jewish family. And they don't want to join the synagogue, but they want some kind of spiritual orientation, or they want a place where they don't have to take on the burden of the Hebrew people necessarily on a religious plane, but they do want to talk about morality. They do want to talk about always leftist political passion. As is the characteristic, the prophetic characteristic of Jews generally. Yeah.
Yeah, I wanted to mention, I have a friend in Longview, Kelso area, where I came from, where I live, and I've known him a number of years, and I grew up with him, and he's been driving, you won't believe this, he's been driving 50 miles to Portland, to this Unitarian church, for 10 or 12 years, okay? All of a sudden, he has quit. And we sat and we talked about it. And he says, I can't handle the gays and the lesbians. He says, man, he says.
They probably don't want to be handled anyway.
Yeah. He said.
Keep your hands off me.
Yeah, he says they run this banner all the way around the church and they, and they're saying, hey, we want all the gays and lesbians to come into the Unitarian Church along with I don't know, Muslims and Jews and Arabs, and he said there's all kinds of individuals there. And he says he got to a point, he said he can't take any more of it. He left. But he did. He drove down there for 12 years, and then he says this woman that's in charge of the church there, she's a lesbian, and he says boy, he said, now see, he was working down there for the church, and they were paying him $25 an hour to work there as a carpenter and a welder and all this, you know, all the professions that I do, they were paying him all this good money and everything.
And he says, this lesbian that becomes the minister, he said, we just didn't hit it off at all. And he says, immediately when we met.
Well, is he going to another church?
Well, no, he's staying home. And I thought, well, I thought maybe I could get him to come to our singles group, you know, at the Lutheran church there. You know? I think he's a super guy, you know.
Yeah.
He's not a left winger or anything like that. He just, mm-hmm. I don't know, but it really surprised me, you know, that all of a sudden he was telling me about the different issues that have been going on.
Yeah. It's a very inclusive fellowship.
Yeah, please.
Question, how does the unity movement relate to Unitarianism, or doesn't it?
Doesn't at all. Unity is from the New Thought movement, generally. Change your mind, change your circumstances. And there are jillions of groups that come from that New Thought idea. And New Thought itself comes from Mesmer. Anton Mesmer died in the early years of the 19th century, but Mesmer was an Austrian physician who came up with the idea that one can have an influence on conditions in the body at a distance. Now, that is one of the central ideas of the alternative reality tradition. The dualistic reality tradition is that if you're going to move something, there has to be a cause that you can account for. You know, I mean, I can say, move you freaking glasses. But as we all know in the reality tradition of the West, I have to move them if they're going to be moved, right? Or blow on them, or, you know, have a torch, or there's got to be some kind of physical movement. Mesmer says, no, you know, you can influence people, you can, what? Mesmerize them, huh? You can, you know, get things happening in the material world, change the material world by non-material means. Now, everybody is thinking, the door is open for a lot of new religious movements with that idea, right? Mm-hmm. You don't have to touch people. Or you can touch them, huh? You can acupressure. I mean, all of this relates to the New Age, because the New Age is a nice parking lot for this idea that you can influence at a distance. And unity is one of those. the goal of unity is peace, health, harmony, joy, advancement in your job, better relationships in your family, with your friends, etc. In other words, it's a health, a psychological health movement using some of the symbols of Christianity, but interpreted according to the New Thought idea. And in that sense, it's competitive with the Church of Religious Science, the Christian Scientists, and others in that New Thought movement. Founded by the Fillmores, F-I-L-L-M-O-R-E, not Millard Fillmore, the famous president, other Fillmores. Headquarters, I mean, this thing gets started in the 1920s. And the headquarters are in Lee's Summit, Missouri, which is near Kansas City, I think. They publish a little booklet that a lot of people use called Daily Word.
Yeah.
You look on the back and it says Unity Village, Lee's Summit, Missouri. And you know, if you're a sort of fundamentalist looking for a lot of gospel stuff, you know, wouldn't find it in there. But if you're just kind of in the doctor's office, you know, and you've read through all the old Golf Digest, you see, hey, man, this is this month's Daily Word. What is this? You know, you read this and you know, have a happy thought, affirm yourself, blah, 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 you know, get in contact with higher power. Oh, this is nice, you know, word for the day. So, I mean, it's kind of harmless stuff, you know, but it's not classic Christianity.
Could be classified as a Christian church under any circumstance, or not really?
Only if your definition is very broad.
Okay.
Yeah.
And how about the Unitarians? If you asked a Unitarian, are you a Christian, would they be more likely to say yes or no?
My experience, and that's all I'm going with, is that they would more likely say no.
Because the people I know who have been Unitarians, or whom I have known who are Unitarians, seem to consider themselves to be Christians. Mm-hmm. But I see them very much as humanists, just in the way they approach everything.
Yeah.
I think it's curious that the ones I've known seem to want to be included in the mainline church mm-hmm. community.
Yeah, I would think the majority, vast majority in our Unitarian Fellowship in Moscow would say no. Mm-hmm. Beginning with the minister. Mm-hmm. She said, I'm not a Christian. She calls herself a theist. That is a person who believes in a divine force that we usually call God. Mm-hmm. So she's not ashamed of that. But her predecessor was a great friend of mine. And Harold said that when he came to the church, one woman came up to him and said, if you pray, I'm leaving. So, see, Unitarian ministers have problems. I mean, you know, it's just like all of us. To pray or not to pray. Yeah.
I went to a Unitarian church Sunday morning in Portland. I don't know if it's the same one you're talking about, Tom.
There's only one there.
Well, that was it. That was my brother who. I decided more than 10 years separates us. We're really different when it comes to faith issues, but it was weird. It was a strange experience. And it's exactly what you're talking about. All references to the spirit of, or the tree of life, or that's the visual way. It was weird. And we got into a kind of a hot discussion afterwards. I said, well, if you still believe in God, why don't you go to a Christian church then? They're really into kind of, you know, the spirituality stuff. I mean, I could sense that, but
yeah.
I said, don't you miss word and sacrament? Don't you miss holy? Yeah. I said, do you have any kind of communion thing? And he said, well, we have this kind of flower ceremony. I said, oh, really? Flower ceremony with communion. Interesting. So I was kind of sitting in the back seat rolling my eyes.
Well, they have their great heroes. There was a Spanish priest in the late 16th century, so after the Reformation, gets some sort of Reformation ideas in his mind. His name is Socinus, S-O-I-N-U-S, S-O-C-I-N-U-S. And he begins thinking, wait, the Trinity idea militates against monotheism. So he's sort of a crypto or proto-Unitarian. And this does not sit well with the Spanish authorities, who are famous for the Inquisition. So Socinus leaves, and he makes a big mistake. He goes to Geneva. And begins preaching his Unitarian Christianity. Now, the person who was overseeing Geneva at this time was Jean Calvin, who takes no prisoners. And so Monsieur Calvin says, Combien? And he was burned at the stake in Calvin's Geneva for this kind of Socinianism. So you will, if you hang around the Unitarians long enough, you'll hear Emerson and Thoreau.
Oh, I heard three poems that morning.
Yeah, I always kid my Unitarian friends. I'd say, you know, if you didn't have Emerson and Thoreau, you couldn't have a service. Aren't you lucky? But they will, you know, talk about Socinus and other greats in their tradition. So it is a tradition, you know. It's not just a thing that's cooked up, you know, lately. It is a tradition.
Bruce, they had a president, too. We had a president that was a Unitarian president. I can't think of the name offhand, but there has been a past president, and they hold him quite high as a Unitarian.
I'm not thinking of who that is offhand, yeah.
I have a family member who's a Unitarian, thinks it's a very comfortable place to be, and she said the one thing they agree on, all Unitarians agree on, is to disagree.
Yes.
And also, she is says that there are many people, as somebody mentioned, they go in and out of the church. They have a high percentage of Jewish people, former Jewish people in the church. People stay a few years and go back to the church maybe they came from, move on into a different thing, maybe they move into nothing. And that's very accepted, and I think we can learn from that something in our traditional church that we need to allow for some movement within our mainstream churches, too. Mm-hmm. That we sometimes, I feel, don't allow. I'm not comfortable in Unitarian church, but it allows for movement and exploring what you believe.
Yes.
And
that's a central idea.
And you think through. Maybe we don't all think. Sometimes we, you know, I believe the way my parents believe, the way my grandparents believe. Mm-hmm. And maybe you have to step aside, those people need to step aside and question for a period of time. So I don't think it's all bad.
No, good point. I asked my Unitarian friend, you say you're a congregation of seekers. What happens if somebody finds something? And she said, well, that's fine, just so that they don't say this is the final truth.
Yeah.
You know, it was a good answer. I thought it was a witty. Okay, anybody else? We've got about 3 minutes here. Otherwise, I'll talk about the Puritans. Talking about the Puritans, because America has been a fertile ground, as I've said before, for the production of new religious movements. Puritanism is a new religious movement within Christianity. Puritanism going back to the Church of England and the feeling among many people in that communion in the 17th century that there was not enough rigor in Christianity. People were becoming spiritually flabby. They were not moral enough. They were not spiritual enough. They didn't pray enough. In other words, they wanted to purify the church. There were two kinds of Puritans, cleverly called separating and non-separating Puritans. Guess which ones came to America? The separating. The non-separating Puritan says, let's stay in the Church of England and cleanse it from within. The separating Puritan said, we can't do that. It's a lost cause. So we're going to leave. Heard any good places lately where we can do our thing and not get persecuted? Yeah, go to Holland. Oh, okay, we'll go to Holland. So they go to Holland and they get homesick. So they come back to England. Things are just as bad. So they decide, is there any other place where we can go and do our thing and not get persecuted? Well, why don't you go to America? Okay. So, you know, Mayflower over to this country eventually produces, this movement does, America's greatest theologian. Now you're going to say, well, that's Abraham Lincoln, right? No, Abraham Lincoln is probably America's second greatest theologian. Yes. But America's greatest native theologian, Jonathan Edwards. The reason we talk about Jonathan Edwards in terms of new religious movements is not necessarily because of his Puritanism relating back to the Church of England, but because Jonathan Edwards was one of the great fomenters of the First Great Awakening. And this was, let us say, the first great new religious movement in American history. 1725. What was happening in 1725? Well, Jonathan Edwards was the pastor of the Congregational, that's the inheritor denominationally of the Puritans, among others. Congregational Church in Northampton, Massachusetts, where Smith College is. 20,000 bucks a year. You could have paid 20 Edwards' lifetime salaries for that. So here was Jonathan Edwards, 1725, looking over the American landscape and over a glass of wine. They were not teetotalers, you know, with his colleagues. He's saying, what is the state of American religion? Are the people going to church? Are the second generation of the Puritans keeping the faith? The first generation was fervent, but is the second generation? Here, now we're in the 18th century. And the answer is no. The answer is that about 15% of the people are going to church. That's all. I mean, at the beginning, of course, it was a church movement. Everybody went to church. I mean, that's why they came here, you know, to the Massachusetts Bay Colony, so they could worship according to the way they wanted to worship. And the assessment of these Puritans was that the second generation is not going to carry on the tradition. This is terrible. What are we going to do? Meanwhile, George Whitefield, 24 years old, comes from England and begins a series of what we might call today crusades. Now, crusades come from the revivalist tradition, which comes from the Second Great Awakening, which gets going in the very last part of the 18th century. But the First Great Awakening is sparked by the intellectual work and preaching of Jonathan Edwards and the preaching of George Whitefield. George Whitefield made a tour of New England around 1725. I don't have the date firmly in mind. You're shocked, I know. And he goes around to the villages and preaches outdoors. Where did he get this idea? From Wesley, from John Wesley. Now, Whitefield didn't become a Methodist, but he did get this idea from Wesley, who itinerated is the Methodist word. You know, he goes around England on his horse. I, by the way, have stood in the pulpit where he preached his first sermon. When you're in Oxford, rent a bike, it's cheap, and go out, I can't tell you exactly where, but it's not too far from inside Oxford. There's a little country lane that says South Lee. You go down there about a mile, there's the Anglican Church. Look at the pulpit, there's a little brass plaque, and it says, in this pulpit, the Reverend Mr. John Wesley.